The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I had such an interesting story this morning. In fact, sometimes you give a class, you're just waiting for the story. So I flew in from Fort Lauderdale. I got off the plane and I walked through security. And right after I walked through security, I realized that I had forgotten something rather important. On the plane, my talis and tefillin, right? Because I left on a very early flight, so I had to pray on the plane, which is an experience in and of itself. And so it was in a separate bag, and it was just sort of a little bag with my tefillin and talis. So it kind of like, I didn't realize it. So I walked right back to the security, said, look, I just got off the plane. I have my little boarding pass and whatever else it is. I just forgot something very important on the plane. They said, I'm sorry, sir, you know, you can't go through. I said, no, I just came out through this very door. So I've been checked, but I'll go through security again. No, because you don't have a ticket to go through security. I said, but I was just on the plane. I just came through that area. Nope, you have to have a ticket to go in and a ticket to go out. So I went to the Delta desk. And I explained to them, you know, I left this bag on the plane and I have to go through. It was an interesting saga. And so they called up the person and they finally found someone at the right gate and they went onto the plane and they came back. And this was like somebody's waiting for me outside and 20 minutes going by, 30 minutes going by. And then they finally said, well, they couldn't find the bag. I'm sorry. You'll have to, whatever. Now I have a pair of tefillin in there. It's a little blue velvet bag, right? With two little boxes and some leather. And it says on the outside, Binyamin Moshe Ben Rav Pinchas in Hebrew letters. And I'm thinking, with everything going on in security today, what will they do when they find this little bag with boxes in it with Hebrew letters on it? They'll probably blow it up. So I said to them, no, you don't understand. It has to be there. They said, well, sometimes people walk off with things. I said, nobody would walk off with this bag. Like, it's tefillin. Like, nobody needs tefillin, right? So I had to describe. They said, well, describe to me what's in this bag. Go explain to this Delta lady what it is I'm looking for. Well, it's leather straps. Leather straps. I said, yeah, what do you do with these leather straps? I said, well, actually, I wear them every morning. And you kind of take a step back sometimes. And she says, well, why do you do this? And I said, well, you know, I'm Jewish, right? We're the chosen people. We've been chosen to wear straps every morning. And you kind of take a step back sometimes. And you ask yourself, where did all this come from? And how does this relate to this grand mission, this dream, this vision of what it means to be a Jew? You know, I remember the first time Michael Yarding, right, Michael Jordan, won his first championship. You know, they had a big, you know, afterwards, the interview. I didn't actually, to be honest, see the game. I didn't see the interview. But the next day, you know, on the news, they're interviewing Michael Jordan. And they ask him, so how does it feel? You know, he apparently, I guess, had been through a saga until they finally won a championship, the Bulls. And he said, it feels good to be the best. Feels good to be the best. And I remember there was something that really bothered me about that statement. What does it mean to be the best? First of all, is it true? Just because you sunk a ball through a hoop a number of times, or just because you put in a tremendous amount of training or willpower, I'm not, God forbid, denigrating the amount of effort it takes to win an NBA championship. But the truth is, when you look at the NBA and you look at all the different teams, so really at the end of the day, your team wins the championship because you happened to get in a few more baskets than the next team, because you caught a few breaks, because the ref was looking the other way, because your coach is a little more shifty, or whatever it is. Does it really make you the best? I mean, if you put the, you know, the New York Knicks next to, I don't know, my high school basketball team, then I could say, yeah, it's fair to compare and to come up with a conclusion. But to be the best? And it raises an interesting question. I was recently having a discussion with somebody, which is actually the reason that we're talking about this evening. We wake up every morning, and we make a blessing. And we make this blessing a number of times. We make it every time we read the Torah. We make it every Friday night. We make Kiddush in a different way. And we bless God, whatever that means, because Bachar Banu Mikol Amim. Right? Ruch Atah Hashem Mekenu Mechalam Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Amim. Bless God who has chosen us from amongst all the nations. V'natamanu et Torato. And he has given us his Torah. To be chosen. We are the chosen people. Just out of curiosity. You can stay safe and just nod your heads. Are there people in this room who are challenged by the idea that we are the chosen people? Right? That we're the best. That somehow we're better than anybody else? Is that what it means? Do we somehow think that we're the best? Now don't get me wrong. You know, there is a value to believing that you're the best. And in fact, it's interesting. The only reason I remember that quote from Michael Jordan is because he apparently made a stink about it, because that was actually not what he said. What he actually said, to his credit, was it's good to feel that you're the best you can be. But of course, that didn't make good headlines. So they cut out those last words. And that makes sense to me. You know, recently, we were sitting around the table on a Sunday. Sunday is a whole different energy in this country. And it's like the extension of Shabbos on a different level, right? But you get to do everything you want to do, right? And we're sitting around the table, and Yair, who's 3.5, looks at me and says, Abba, you're the best. Ugh, you know, like you melt, right? And then he looks at me and says, am I the best? Now, Yonatan is sitting there, and Adi is sitting there. So that's a loaded question if there ever was one. Then he gets up on the chair, right, in his bright Spider-Man underpants, and a cape, and nothing else, and says, I'm the best, right? So of course I gave him the only answer you can give him as a father. You are absolutely the best 3-year-old boy in this family. And he loved that, right? And we got away with it. Because how can one child be the best? That's ridiculous. And yet, how can any one of your children not be the best? What does it mean to be the best? And why is this so much a part of our Jewish experience that we relive this, re-experience it, are re-challenged by it every day? What does it mean, asher bachar banu, that we are chosen by God? What does it mean to be the chosen people? Why is it that Friday night when we make Kiddush, somehow, we have to re-experience this again? Right? And just to extend the question, this particular discussion that I was having with this fellow, what he was troubled by actually doesn't bother me at all. He thought that the idea of a chosen people is a really racist idea. That it speaks of Aryanism, something that led to terrible things just 60 years ago. And that somehow there's this elitist, racist idea that's inculcated in the Jewish people. And actually, this was his way of explaining why he wanted to have nothing to do with Judaism. You would be hard-pressed to convince me that the idea of being chosen has anything to do with racism. That Judaism could be racism. In fact, the idea of Zionism equated with racism is a ridiculous idea. There are Jews from just about every background in the world you can imagine. There are white Jews and black Jews and red Jews and yellow Jews. Jews can come from the Far East and the Near East. They can come from South America, France, English. You can have English and French Jews sitting next to each other. So it can't be that there's racism among Jews. Makes no sense. And if you walk around Israeli society, you can see it's like an Israeli salad. The Israeli salad, they cut the vegetables so small that it's like one blend of colored mush, right? And you know, I like Israeli salad. I never get the salad. I never understood how Israeli an Israeli salad was until we came to Boca. And we went to somebody's house on Shabbos. My kids are sitting at the table, and they bring out the salad. And my aunt is like looking at the salad, and I notice she's got one of these faces, right? And I'm like, my aunt, what's the matter? It's salad. She goes, look how big those pieces of cucumber are. She said, do you think maybe they didn't have a knife, or they don't know how to cut up salad? Should I offer to help cut the salad? Right? Because that's what we do. We cut it all up, and it all blends into one mush. Challenge! And that's Israeli society. You go to the Israeli bus station on Friday afternoon, and you hear Hebrew spoken in just about every dialect you can imagine. Jews from Ethiopia, and Jews from South Africa, and Jews from America, and not enough, and Jews all over the world, right? So the idea of Judaism is racism, I'll be honest with you, at the end of class, if anybody struggles with that idea, you can ask, we can schmooze. I imagine that that's not a huge issue. But this idea that we're chosen, that we're somehow better, that's something we have to deal with. And by the way, since I brought it up, it's not really by the way, I plan to bring it up, but I say it that way. Friday night, when you say Asher Bachar Banu, when you say God chose us, it's an interesting piece, right? You finish the blessing on the wine, Bori Pri Gafen, right? And then basically, Asher Kedishanu V'mitzvotav V'ratzavanu. We bless God who has sort of sanctified us, kadoshed us with his mitzvot, right? Okay? V'ratzavanu. And he wants us, which is a very powerful statement, right? And then eventually, kivanu v'chartu mikolam, everybody sings this, you know? You get a table, Yonatan loves this, whenever he does Kiddush, he's our 9-year-old, whenever he does Kiddush, and he gets all the students singing at the table, he gets this big grin on his face, like, you know, right? He loves that, right? So what are you singing? Because you have chosen us, we're better than everybody else. So that's a very strange, and what does that have to do with Shabbat? I mean, if you read the language in the prayer there, because you have sanctified us, because you wanted us, because you gave us, right, the Shabbat as an inheritance, because you chose us. So somehow Shabbat is intimately involved with the fact that we're chosen. What does that mean? What does it mean to be chosen? And by the way, one of the interesting challenges of this, and you can find many an article that suggests this, is that in some sick way, because we believe that we're the chosen people, that we somehow bear responsibility for the pain that we've experienced in our Jewish history. That anti-Semitism is a result of our perception that we're chosen. That if we didn't think that we were better than everybody else, then nobody would bother with us. Now, of course, that's a ridiculous statement, but why is that a ridiculous statement? I mean, it's just, you know, when there's one kid in the playground who thinks he's better than anybody else, he's going to have difficulties. So shouldn't we try to root this out? Wouldn't it be great if we weren't chosen? We're just Jewish. We're not chosen to be Jewish. We're Jewish. And yet you can't do that. We are known as the chosen people. It's part of the Torah. It's part of tradition. And I want to understand that. What's the positive energy that comes out of that idea? Now, by the way, what's challenging about this is that if you look in Jewish sources seem to imply that we aren't actually better than anybody else. For example, there's a Tosefta in Sanhedrin, whatever, an addendum to the Mishnah, the 13th Tosefta, the 13th Mishnah, that describes the fact that anyone from the nations of the world can become righteous among the nations of the world, and they have a portion in the world to come. A chelek in olam haba. As a matter of fact, it is much easier for someone who isn't Jewish to get into the world to come than it is for someone who's Jewish, right? Because someone who isn't Jewish, at least from a Jewish perspective, has 7 mitzvot that they've got to struggle with, right? They don't have to worry about the rabbinical certification on the cheeseburger. So I got news for you. We're all going to get a big surprise. All these guys, you know, we're all excited, all us rabbis. We get upstairs and we get to the world to come, I hope, you know, and it's going to be full of Irish Catholics because it's much easier for them to get in. And in fact, not only that, but there's an amazing Psikta de Be'eliyahu that talks about the fact that Kol Adam, right? Any human being, Ben Mizera Yisrael, whether he is from the seed of Israel, or Ben Mumot Olam, whether he's from the nations of the world, any human being has the ability to cause the Shekhinah, the divine presence, to rest upon him or her. It's a beautiful idea. So the fact that we think we're chosen does not mean that we're better than anybody else. Because anybody can develop a relationship with the Shekhinah. By the way, here's a newsflash. You can develop a relationship with the Shekhinah, with the divine presence, okay, as a non-Jew, without Judaism. Don't think that what I'm saying is that every human being can become a Jew, they can convert, which is true, right? Judaism is not an exclusive society. You just want to be sure that if somebody wants to convert to Judaism, what does that mean? Is it just putting on, you know, something on your head, or is it something deeper? But if a person wants to take that step, any human being can become Jewish if they're willing to struggle with what that means. But that's not what I'm talking about. If you're an Italian and you live in Little Italy, right, and you eat pizza all day, but you fulfill these 7 mitzvot and you're a fine human being, then you can get into the world to come. So what does it mean that we're chosen, that we're better? And is that really what it means? So, in order to deal with this question, I want to focus us on another piece, which is fascinating. And I didn't know when we picked this topic that this would actually fall on this week. But it's kind of funny that the portion of this week actually is the beginning of this question, of this journey. We read the portion, the Shabbat, hopefully we don't just read it, we learn it. It's called Yitro, right? Jethro. Yitro was Moshe's father-in-law. And this is actually the portion, what famous event occurs in this week's portion? 10 Commandments, right? We kind of studied that some of us, right? Giving of the Torah, Mount Sinai, which was a pretty significant event in Jewish history. You know, it's up there, right? Mount Sinai, got the Torah, talk to God, it's important, right? And it's in this week's portion called Yitro. Ask me a question.
Why is it called Yitro?
Thank you. $50, no problem, right? As an aside, why is this portion called Yitro? But much more fascinating to me is the beginning of this portion. I would have thought that the beginning of this portion, which deals with the giving of the Torah, should begin with that story. That we should begin this portion with the Jews traveled through the desert and they arrived at the foot of Sinai. And they began their preparations for this intense, mystical, magical experience. And everything else. But before I get there, I have a little story. And this story just doesn't seem to fit. Vayishma Yitro Kohen Midyan, and Yitro, a Kohen of Midyan. Now, you can look at rabbinic sources, the Medrash, the oral tradition. He gave up his idolatrous ways. He became, you know, a Ger Tzedek, a righteous among the nations. And that could all be, right? But that's not how the Torah describes him. So let's discuss this from the context of the written word. Yitro is called a Kohen Midyan. A Kohen of Midyan means a priest of the Midianites. The Midianites were not a monotheistic religion. He's a Midianite. Vayishma Yitro, and he hears at Kol Asher Asa Elohim leMoshe. He hears everything that God has done to Moshe and for the Jewish people, Yisrael Amo, Ki Yotzi Hashem et Yisrael Mitzrayim, because God has taken the Jewish people out of Egypt. So Yitro, Vayikach Yitro, Yitro takes his Moshe's wife, who for some reason isn't with him, that's another discussion, takes Moshe's kids, maybe that's why he comes, right? He wants to load them back to their husband, could be, he's a father-in-law, smart guy, right? And he shows up at Sinai. So first of all, just as an aside, there's an amazing question by the Talmud. The Gemara asks, V'chima shama Yitro uva? What did Yitro hear that caused him to come? Like it says, Vayishma Yitro, and Yitro heard. What made Yitro come? So many of the commentaries ask a very good question. What do you mean, what did Yitro hear? It says what Yitro heard. It says, Vayishma Yitro, and Yitro heard. At Kol Asher Asa Hashem, everything that God did, L'moshe, L'vnei Yisrael, L'moshe, L'vnei Yisrael, L'mitzayim, that Yitro heard that everything God had done to the Jewish people, 10 plagues, I mean, you can debate whether this book is an authentic book. I obviously have a strong opinion on the matter. And you can debate whether this really happened. But within the context of this story, if, in fact, in ancient Egypt, the mightiest empire on the face of the earth, at the time, the center of all, I mean, you know, at least within the context of the story, and by the way, historically, gets basically wiped out. This mighty army somehow sinks. All these miracles, a huge slave population just walks out of Egypt. You gotta figure people heard about it. Right? So Yisro hears about it, and he comes. And the Torah tells me why he comes. He comes because he heard about it. So what's the Talmud's question? Why did Yitro come? So the Tzemach Tzedek says an amazing thing. One of the Lubavitch Rebbe's says an amazing thing. He says the question is not what did Yitro hear that he came. The question is what did Yitro hear that made him come? You see, everybody heard about this. In fact, there's a beautiful Song of the Sea that we just read in last week's portion. And one of the verses in there, it says, Azna Mogu Kol Yoshvei Kenan, then all of the Canaanites trembled. They heard about this all the way in Canaan. Everybody heard about this. But nobody came. It's an amazing question. You know, we always ask the question about the Jewish people. They come, they see all this. How come they're still struggling? What about the rest of the world? Where is the rest of the world when all of these miracles are taking place? How come the Jewish people walked out of Egypt alone? Why didn't all the Egyptians say, you know what, I could have had a V8. Why didn't they come up with all of them? Where's the world? Out of the whole world, and everybody who's listening and seeing all these plagues, there's one guy who gets it enough to come. That's the Gemara's question. And by the way, the Talmud does not really answer this question. The Talmud doesn't answer this question. And you see this, by the way, as a theme in the Torah. For example, Abraham. There is a pretty significant piece of the story of Abraham that we are entirely missing in the Torah. What is that piece? It's the most important part of Abraham's story. We meet Abraham when he's over 70 years old, and God self, Hashem, comes to visit Abraham. And out of the blue, this Nebuchadnezzar Yid, who's the only Yid about to become a Yid, doesn't realize what trouble he's getting himself into. And Hashem comes along and says, Lech lecha me'artzecha, me'latetcha, me'beit avicha, et sharecha. Leave everything. I mean, could you imagine? You're sitting here, you have a great job, you're working with Price Waterhouse, right? And, you know, everything is great. And you just met the girl of your dreams. And you love your in-laws. It's amazing. It's unbelievable. And they've put you in. You're working in the family firm. And you come home one night for dinner. And you say, honey, I heard a voice. God came to me. And God said to me, thou shalt leave Price Waterhouse in New York City and your family. And thou shalt go to the desert to live in Beersheba. Okay? Your wife would search for the biggest pan. Right? I mean, it's nuts. So you have to assume that if Avram just picks up and go, he must have this incredible relationship with God. Avram is the only individual in the world at that time, maybe one exception,
who has such a relationship with a monotheistic entity that we call Hashem. Historians, by the way, amazingly, nothing to do with Judaism, secular, non-Jewish historians, all agree that monotheism came onto the world stage through the Jewish people. That Christianity and Islam are offshoots of a Jewish idea. And in general, historians are completely confounded as to how this idea came about. How did an individual, a group, come up with this ridiculous idea that there's a God that you can't see, that you can't hear, that you can't touch, that you can't feel, that there's no relationship with, that doesn't give you anything, in the midst of a world of pagan idolatry? How did that develop? We have no idea. And you know why we have no idea? Because the Torah doesn't tell me. I would have thought it would be very important for the Torah to tell me how Avram finds this relationship with God. It's completely missing. And I remember once, I had an amazing story, at the risk of being tangential, but it's nothing new. There was a fellow who ran a Jewish nursing home. And he had a big inspection from the Board of Health. You know, he was very nervous. And it wasn't a Jewish nursing home. He was a Jewish fellow, firm guy, whatever that means, you know. And these inspectors were coming in for 3 days, going through the kitchen and the health facilities and the nursing care and the meds and everything. And he was terrified because, you know, these guys, they don't like something. Somebody left a piece of toilet paper, they shut you down. And he shuts you down for a month, you know, your life is over, forget it. So he's doing everything he can to please these fellows and everything is good. And it's the third day of the inspection, it's Friday afternoon, right? And he's sitting in his office and they're off on a tour. And one of them comes back in and he puts his hand down on the desk. He says, I want you to know, if you don't stop feeding the dog food to your patients, we're going to shut you down. The guy's mouth opens up. He says, what are you talking about? He says, we found out about your little scam. And we're going to shut you down. He says, what are you talking about? Turns out there's one Jewish lady in this whole nursing home. And at a certain point in her experience in the nursing home, right, 93, 94 years old, this guy found out that she was Jewish. Now, it's not a Jewish nursing home, so he gives everybody non-kosher food. So he didn't know what to do. So he asked a rabbi, am I allowed to give her non-kosher food? Or do I have to give her kosher food? The rabbi says, no, you can't give non-kosher food to a Jew unless they want it, but, you know, whatever, right? So out of his own pocket, he decided to order, like, you know, airplane meals, kosher food, you know, shradlers, whatever, for this woman. So when the health inspectors came around and they see a 94-year-old woman and everybody else is eating one type of food and she's eating this special airplane food, they asked her, what are you eating? So she looks up and she says, they won't let me eat regular food. They give me dog food. Right? The health inspector, right? So he said, she says that you're giving her dog food. We asked her if she wants regular food. She says yes. Right? If you don't give her regular food, we're going to shut you down. This is discrimination. Can't do it. So he doesn't know what to do. It's Friday afternoon. Now he has to get home for Shabbos. It always happens Friday afternoon. So he goes to talk to this lady. He says, look, you don't understand. I give you this food because it's kosher. They're going to shut me down. She says, I don't care. I want whatever everybody else is eating. And he's got a problem. He calls up a rabbi. He says, look, I've got this problem. They're going to shut me down. Am I allowed to give her tray food? No, you're not allowed to give her tray food. Can't be, you know, a vehicle to give somebody else food that's unkosher, right? It's not, you know, she wants to go out and buy it. But if you're going to have to give it to her, you can't do it. Now, whether that's true or not, whether he went to the wrong rabbi, that's another discussion. But he doesn't know what to do. So he's telling the story over to his friend. And he says, of course, Monday morning they came back and this woman agreed to have kosher food. And that's how we solved the problem. So the guy looks at me and says, what? Excuse me? What do you mean? He says, well, I told you that, you know, she wouldn't eat, you know, unkosher food. And so Monday morning they were going to shop it. Now she eats kosher food. He says, what do you mean? How did she eat kosher food? You missed the most important part of the story. He says, I just told you. They said they were going to shut me down if I didn't figure out a way to get her to agree to eat kosher food. So she had kosher food. So sometimes there's a part of the process that you can't define. And it's because it comes from a place of necessity, of desire, of knowledge, of need, that you can't define. And maybe that's what's going on here. And we see this again and again and again in the Torah. We have no idea how Avram develops a relationship with God. And we have no idea how Moshe develops a relationship with God. And so the Torah and the Gemara, for that matter, Talmud, does not actually tell me. Maybe because it's individual to a person. Now, I mention this because we have this very often. People very often come and they're looking for the recipe. They're looking for the recipe. How do I find God? How do I find Judaism? How do I find that special someone? And everybody thinks it's a recipe. It's an amazing thing. It's not really a recipe. So Yitro comes along, out of the blue, and you think, wow, this is incredible. But you know what Yitro does? Yitro leaves. He comes along, he gives Moshe a suggestion. Okay? And he tells Moshe, Moshe is sitting too long every day, right? The people are, you know, sort of asking Moshe questions. Nebuchadnezzar, Lubavitcher Rebbe, right? And all day and all night, people are asking questions. It's ridiculous. The guy can't sleep. The guy can't get anything done. So Yitro sees this. He says, Ma'an davar hazeh, what are you doing? Maduata yoshev v'chavi, he's sitting on your own. So he gives him a whole suggestion. And he tells him, you know, lo tova davar asher atah aseh, this is no good. You know, father-in-laws, they give you advice. You got to listen, right? Lo tova davar, it's not good. Navol tibol, you're going to get destroyed. Ki kaved mecha, it's too difficult. Shema b'koli, listen to what I'm going to tell you. Iyatzcha, I'm going to give you a piece of advice. And it'll work out. And he tells him you should bring different judges and they should come and these judges should sit with smaller groups and you should have lower courts and upper courts and higher courts and supreme courts till it gets all the way back to you. Moshe, quite incredibly, listens to this advice and does what Yitro says and appoints these judges and sets up a whole system, a whole judiciary, a whole system of ethics. Vayivchar Moshe anshei chayil, and Moshe chooses men of valor. V'shaftu et ha'am, and in fact they do judge the people when they need it. And then here comes the last verse of this little story. Vayelech lo el arzo. And so Yitro goes back home. Now I want you to understand. There's a way of reading the story that Yitro doesn't actually go home before Sinai, but even if Yitro does not actually go home before Sinai, the Torah presents it in the way that he does, so let's assume for the moment he does. That's incredible. There are two things about this that are incredible. First of all, imagine that you have a good friend. And he's about to have a private meeting with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, because he's got a difficult question. And you bump into him. You say, hey, what are you doing in Crown Heights? He says, well, you know, I'm reading the Lubavitcher Rebbe, of course today that would be pretty impressive. I'm meeting the Lubavitcher Rebbe, right? I got this really difficult question, and I'm going to meet with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And you say to him, oh, you know what? I'll tell you the answer to that question. Let me tell you what you have to do. So, with all due deference to whoever thinks I'm talking about them, that makes you somewhat of an idiot. Because, I mean, he's talking to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So Yitro comes in, he sees Mo, and Moshe's about to have this incredible experience, going to go up and talk to God. Ten Commandments. Pretty impressive. And so Yitro says, no, here's what you do. And incredibly, Moshe listens. Why doesn't Moshe say to Yitro, listen, that's very nice, but I'm going to talk to God. I'll bring your suggestion to the boss. No! And the Torah makes a point of telling me that this whole system, this judiciary system, gets set up by Yitro, who is a Midianite Kohen. He's like chief idolatry man. In fact, Rashi, one of the commentators, describes Yitro mefatei magalim. He fattens calves for the sacrifices to the idols. That's incredible. And the Torah gives me this story right before Sinai. Almost as though I have to hear this before Sinai. If the Torah wants to give me a judiciary system and teach me a system which is the backbone of creating an ethical society, don't you think if God's about to give the vision for how we're going to use this recipe of Torah to create a world of ethics, don't you think it should come from God? It comes from Yitro. And then, by the way, Yitro, demonstrating perhaps that he's not there, actually leaves right before Sinai. Could you imagine being there around the corner from Mount Sinai and hearing Moshe say, listen, we got this great program for tomorrow night's lecture. God's going to come and speak. He says, no, you know, I've had enough for the day. I'm going home, but let me know how it goes. It's ridiculous. You get a big posting on the internet, the 10-part series, you know, 10 commandments. Unbelievable. Yitro leaves, and this has to get to... The Torah takes the time to show me this whole story so that I will see that this is the introduction to Sinai. Now, what's amazing about that is that what really is the experience of Sinai? The experience of Sinai is where we become chosen by God as a people. Up until this point, we have been chosen or chosen God as individuals. Now, as a reflection of the whole experience of the Exodus from Egypt, God chooses us and chooses to give us this gift that we call Torah. And there seems to be a relationship between Torah and chosenness. As a matter of fact, the way I experience and identify with my chosenness every morning is Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Amim, who has chosen us among all the nations, v'natan lanu et Torato, and given us Torah. So Torah is the reflection of the fact that I'm chosen. What am I chosen for? To get Torah. I could have been chosen for many things. I could have been chosen to eat kosher food. I could have been chosen for Shabbat. But I'm chosen for Torah. Now you could argue that everything is within Torah, and that's okay. But Torah represents my chosenness. So this is the point where I become chosen, because this is the point where we get Torah. And right before we get chosen, the Torah makes a point of showing me that the entire system can come from outside of Torah. And from outside of God. If every human being can be outside of God, at least within the context of the story. So you could say, well, what do you want? That's the way it happened. Well, but that's ridiculous. And Hashem creates the world, and Hashem creates everything, and Hashem, things happen the way Hashem wants them to happen. So if Yitro is coming with this system, and the Torah tells me that this comes from Yitro, it's because that's part of Hashem's plan, that it should come from Yitro. What am I supposed to learn from this? What does this mean? So I guess the first question, in understanding chosenness, and in understanding chosenness's relationship with Torah and with Shabbat, because again, Shabbat somehow I experienced being chosen, is understanding that there are two different pieces to this concept of Bechila, to this idea of being chosen. The first question is whether in fact we are chosen by God or we chose God. And I want you to know, that's where I was to a certain point, at least personally. Because, you know, if anybody's ever had a discussion on this topic, that's usually the response that comes up. Right? That in fact, God didn't choose Avraham until Avraham chose God. Right? That we as a people, and of course, what comes up, does anybody know the text that comes up? There's a famous medrash. Right? God supposedly goes around to the nations of the world. Now, by the way, midrash, rabbinic legend, not necessarily meant to be taken literally. Many of the great commentaries share that medrash, that rabbinic legend, which is really the backbone of the oral tradition. In other words, the stories came from particular rabbis. This is one way of understanding it. But the messages are part of the oral tradition all the way back in time to Moshe. One doesn't necessarily have to assume that these messages are literal. In other words, for example, if there's a medrash that Abraham's father had an idol store, you know, and that he broke all the idols, or if there's a donkey that, you know, goes flying and is waiting for the Mashiach, you don't have to necessarily literally assume that that's the case, right? That's what many of the great rabbis suggested, the Gaon, the Rashbam, the Ramchal, many of the Rambam. But there is a message there, an allegory that you have to understand. So, there's a medrash, and the medrash says that God goes around to all the nations of the world, and he wants to know, who wants my Torah? Right? So he comes to the Edomites, he says to the Edomites, do you want my Torah? So the Edomites say, well, what's in the Torah? He says, don't kill. I mean, don't kill. That's what we do for a living. We're hunters. We can't do that. So they say, no, next week. Right? Give us the next party. So he goes to the Ishmaelites. And the Ishmaelites say, what's in the Torah? And he says, well, don't steal. They say, oh, you know, that's what we do. We can't do that. And he goes around nation to nation. And then he comes to the Jewish people. And the Jewish people, you know, he says, do you want my Torah? And they say, sure. Na'aseh v'nishma. Give us the Torah. We'll do whatever you want. It's a ridiculous medrash. Ridiculous medrash. First of all, you look at this medrash. All the other nations are bright. And I always think, like, you know, if the Jewish people would have been a little more awake that morning, because what happened was they had a schnapps, they had like a good shot that morning, they weren't thinking straight. They should have said, what's in the Torah? And God would have said, you know, lo te'lech rachil ba'amecha, you're not supposed to gossip in the back of shul. And they would have said, forget it, right? But it didn't work that way, right? It's a ridiculous premise. First of all, even within the context of the Medrash, it's not really fair. God loads it up. And second of all, on a deeper level, it's absurd to imagine that we only chose Torah. If there is a God, and Hashem creates the world, there are only two possibilities within the framework of our existence. There is randomness, or there is purpose. And if there is purpose, then everything has purpose. Whether we're supposed to try to figure out that purpose, that's a different question. And you can drive yourself a little nuts trying to assume that everything has purpose. You know, you cross the street, and a car drives by and splashes you with a puddle, and you stop where you are thinking, what deep message am I supposed to learn from that puddle, right? The next thing, a truck runs you down because you're so busy with a puddle. So I'm not saying that's what... But when you step back on a grand scheme, you have to assume that there is purpose. So of course we were meant to receive the Torah. So it's ridiculous to assume that we chose the Torah. It's true that it's a partnership, and we've said that many times. But what does that mean? So I want you to understand that that leads you to the second question. You see, the question is not, are we chosen? The question is, what are we chosen for? And I wonder if what the Torah is telling me here is that everybody is chosen. Everybody's chosen. You know, we have this assumption sometimes, because we develop a relationship with Judaism, with Torah, with truth, that we've discovered truth. And I want you to know, that is a very dangerous perception. To assume that there is no other path to truth is very dangerous. We are somehow, all of us, chosen. Every human being and every nation. And because we are chosen for what we are chosen for, so I have to understand that. Part of your life is how you're chosen. You're born, and you develop certain skills. And it's a dangerous thing to assume that those skills have so much to do with you. They're a gift that you're given. And there are people, unfortunately, who walk through the world and they pat themselves on the back for the gift that they received that had very little to do with what they did. If you grow up in a certain way, with the right role models, you will become X. And some of it has nothing to do with the recipe. You're born to be who you are. Well, we assume Leonardo da Vinci did tremendous things to become a great artist. He developed his skill. But he was given the gift of art. And Leonard Bernstein was given the gift of music. And the Rambam was given the gift of intellectual mastery over Torah. So there is a part of the recipe that is what I'm given. And so being chosen is a gift. But it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm more chosen than anybody else. In fact, one of the greatest challenges is to recognize what Hashem has chosen me for. Then I can begin to figure out, what do I do with that? That's the challenge of life. The challenge of life is to figure out what I have to give back to this world. How did Hashem choose me? And what can I do with that choice? It's amazing. What does chosenness have to do with Shabbat? Think about it. It says nowhere that I could find that because the Jewish people are chosen, that means that anybody else is not chosen. And there are certain texts that are challenging given this idea. For example, and we're almost done, at the end of Shabbat, right around Mincha, the afternoon service, we get to the pinnacle of the ideas that we're trying to develop through Shabbat. And what does it say? Atai echad, you are one, v'shimcha echad, u'miki amcha Yisrael goy echad v'aretz. And who is like unto Israel, one nation in the world? We are one nation. We are unique. And people make the mistake of assuming that because I'm unique, you're not. But I got news for you. You will not find, again, to the best of my knowledge, anywhere in the Torah that it says that because I'm unique, anyone else isn't. Everybody's unique. There's a nation that isn't unique. There's a nation that wasn't created with a purpose. There's a nation that wasn't created with something to give the world. You know, one of the biggest challenges, this is actually part of what we're going through today, is that every nation has its purpose. And what happens when a particular nation is not fulfilling its purpose? Maybe, and there are mystical ideas to suggest this, but I'm not going to go all the way down that road. Maybe there are other nations whose purpose is actually to bring those nations back to their purpose. It's a radical idea. There's an idea in the pre-tzaddik that suggests that the nation of Yishmael has a purpose in this world. Yishmael, right, the descendants of Yishmael are the Arab nations today. That the nations of Yishmael have a purpose. And that their purpose is precisely their name. Yishmael. That the world should hear that there's a God. They're meant to somehow spread, and they're not the only one, but they're meant to somehow spread monotheism in the world. And when you think about it, it's amazing. Because the Jewish people may have brought monotheism into the world, but we didn't spread it to the world. One of the offshoots of Judaism, Yishmael in this case, has spread monotheism to over 1 billion people in the world. In fact, the reason that you can walk halachically into a mosque is because a mosque is not idolatry, it's not about Israel. We worship the same God. It's amazing. And then there's another idea which is actually frightening that you can find in texts of 2,000 years ago, which interestingly actually happened when we were building the second temple, is that when we as a people don't hear our purpose, when we don't live up to who we can be, when we don't appreciate what our gift is, why we're chosen and what we have to do with the world, or to give to the world, then perhaps that nation Yishmael has another purpose, which is to remind us that we need to think about what our purpose is. And that is so deep. Because maybe, again, maybe I don't claim to have the copyright on truth. Maybe that's what's really happening in the world. We're also convinced that the whole problem is that George Bush doesn't tell Arafat where to go. And I'm not saying that would be nice. You think that's the issue? You think the real issue is that George Bush and Yasser Arafat can't get their act together? That Sharon doesn't do this? From their perspective, that may be the issue, but that's not our perspective. My perspective is that our issue has nothing to do. If we could figure out what we're meant to be here for, if we could get our act together as a people, believe me, we wouldn't have a problem with the Palestinians. We wouldn't have a problem with anybody. It'd be incredible. And so that, of course, leads you to the next question, which is the final question. So what are we chosen for? What is our mission in this world? What are we meant to do? What are we meant to share? What are we meant to give? It's an interesting thing. You know, Judaism popped into the world, and for a long time, through 2,000 years of exile, has been struggling with the tension of two almost antithetical paths. On the one hand, what you might call religious fanaticism. The religious fanatic is so convinced of the truth of God that he becomes convinced that God is above all else. And that God is more important than humanity and more important than human ethics. Therefore, I can do everything in the name of God. And because God exists, man is completely unimportant. Then there is, call it for the moment, the secular, whatever that means, humanism. Reason, ethics, human beings. That humanity is what's really important. And God is completely unimportant. God is dead. And therefore man is the center of the world. But of course, if God is dead, then man is not created in the image of God. Man is only created in the image of matter. And if man is created only in the image of matter, then human beings essentially are matter. And that's why the two principal proponents of this idea, communism and Nazism, were ultimately responsible for the beginning of turning human beings into matter. Because if a human being is created in the image of matter, then after all, we're just matter. So why not turn us into lampshades or soap? It's a frightening thought when you think about it. And the Jewish people came into this world to teach the world that there's a synthesis, that there's a balance, that it's not about putting God ahead of my fellow human being. But neither is it about putting my fellow human being ahead of God. It's about seeing God in every human being and recognize that every human being is created in the image of God. And there's a whole recipe to be able to bring this into the world. And when we say that we're chosen, perhaps what it means is that we're given such a gift. And that gift carries with it an awesome responsibility. And our challenge is, what do we do with that gift? There are very few things in this world that are more heartbreaking. And to meet someone who has such a gift doesn't even know he has a gift. Someone who has a gift knows he has a gift and could care two hoots about it. It's heartbreaking. It's mind-boggling. That is our challenge today as Jewish people. We have been given such a gift, such a heritage. It's awesome. And this world so needs what that heritage has to offer. But maybe the reason that this appears at the beginning of Yitro is before you begin your relationship with me, says Hashem, before you come all the way up on Sinai, and we talk to each other face to face, before we get into this relationship, I want you to know, don't make the mistake of assuming that this is the only recipe for truth. Because if you think that this is the recipe for truth, if you think that it exists only in Torah and nowhere else, then you'll forget that the purpose of this is to give something to the rest of the world. And so we begin a system of judicial ethics with Yitro. He doesn't even stay for Sinai. Maybe it almost as if to say, perhaps what the Torah is saying is that there's truth elsewhere in the world. But because I was born Jewish, and because I'm given this gift, I can spend my life, you know, you can be born with the gift of piano. You can have an incredible gift. And you can decide that to give that gift to the world, I want you to know, people struggle with, what do? I know I'm talented at this, but I love doing that. This is an opinion. You can take it or leave it. In order to really fulfill myself in this world, I have to find out what my chosenness really is about. What am I here for? If you think about the moments in life that are our darkest, they're not about externalities. You meet people who have the most difficult experience and they live in a state of joy. And you meet people who have everything and they should be full of joy and they're so empty. It's not about what's around me. It's about what's inside me. If I can discover why I'm here, and discovering why I'm here is discovering what I've been given to give to the world, and if I can develop that gift so that I'm really giving something to the world, that is the experience of true joy. Joy is about purpose. That's our challenge as a people and as individuals. And we seem to have lost that. We seem, as a people, to have forgotten why we're here and what our purpose is. And that's what the Torah is going to remind us of. And that's our challenge. And maybe over the course of the next number of weeks, we can begin to explore that topic a little more in depth. And I hope, Bezrat Hashem, that we all, as a people and as individuals, begin at least the journey, in whatever way we need to discover why we're really here and what we have to give to the world, which brings us so much joy, which is the only real way you can give to the world. That's a little food for thought on the concept of being chosen. Anybody have any questions?
Before we take questions, one quick announcement. I want to welcome Yehuda Avital from Darna, who provides the food for us every week. I have you guys should all go to this restaurant. It's on 89th in Columbus. Incredible food. We eat it here every week. Tremendous.
Thank you very much. I've been wanting to meet you for a while. Okay, so let me take your question. I do want to, by the way, say one thing, which is that it's all great to talk about Jewish ethics. I'll give you an opportunity to put this into practice. This Thursday night,
at Eish, or Thursday, it's all day Thursday, at Eish HaTorah, okay, which is on 83rd, right, between West End and Riverside. There is a bone marrow drive. We've spoken about this before. It's a huge mitzvah. Every Jew, every person, has a responsibility to do this. It is so simple. It's a cotton swab or a brick, and you can be put into this drive, and then if you will ever be a match for anyone, anywhere in the world, anytime, they will find you, and you can save someone's life. So, big mitzvah to do this.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.